My name is Robert Hawkins. It's 6:42 a.m. on Saturday, May 23rd. Approximately 7 hours ago, something attacked the city. I don't know what it is. If you found this tape, I mean, if you're watching this right now, then you probably know more about it than I do. Whatever it is, it killed my brother. The military has begun bombing the creature, and we're caught in the middle.
Welcome to Now Playing Podcast's Cloverfield Bonus Retrospective Series.
This experiment could unleash chaos, the likes of which we have never seen. Monsters, demons, beasts from the sea.
Hosted by Arnie.
I'm always watching. Always.
Stuart.
A lot of people think he's from a planet that he's not actually from.
And Jacob.
We have to stay focused. We have other problems to deal with.
This podcast may contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
Oh, I could just see this ending up on the internet.
Listener discretion is advised.
People need to see this, you know? This is going to be important.
Today, we're going to 10 Cloverfield Lane, starring Mary Elizabeth Winstead, John Goodman, John Gallagher Jr., directed by Dan Trachtenberg. This is Now Playing. My name is Arnie, by the way.
And Stuart.
And this is Jacob, and you need to show me some appreciation.
How does one make a Cloverfield 2? I mean, there's a reason why it took, what, 8 years to get a semi-sequel, quasi? I mean, it's not even really a direct sequel. It's not found footage. It's not in New York. It doesn't have the same monster in it.
But they played this close to the vest. As I mentioned last show, when this came out, I didn't see it. I was the newbie to the series. I saw this for the first time for this review. But when this movie came out, I remember hearing the plot line is basically people are trapped in a bunker because of a disaster that took place above, and they wouldn't say it wasn't the same monster. They wouldn't say how this is tied to Cloverfield. They just said, you have to see the movie and you'll know how it's tied. So I was sure that it would be the same monster outside the building. And in fact, having watched it, I don't know why it isn't, but...
Yeah, no, So when I first watched this, I talked about in the last show, when I first saw Cloverfield, it was in 2016, it was on Netflix. My wife's like, oh, you might like this one. I remember enjoying it. Let's watch it. Rewatched it, re-enjoyed it. And I said, you know, there's a sequel that just, it had just come out, I think, where you could rent it online or whatever, called 10 Cloverfield Lane. I'm like, let's watch that. Like, this was good. Let's watch this now. I'm like, I don't know how much of a sequel it is, but I remember the entire time. I'm like, oh, those noises above. That's the monster. When's the monster showing up? That's all I thought about that entire movie, waiting for the monster to show up.
My memory was they wouldn't even confirm it was a Cloverfield sequel. They weren't even saying that there were ties. That was so long ago, who even remembers that movie? I mean, Cloverfield wasn't that big a hit. 80 million in the States, and no obvious way. There's a devil on the shoulder and an angel on the shoulder. The devil is Blair Witch, right? You can't do it again. It's impossible to manufacture. And then on the other hand, Paramount is having a lot of success cranking out Paranormal Activity movies and making $100 million a pop each time and keeping it found footage. So there had to be some temptation. I know that JJ is on the record saying he looked at a lot of scripts and there were a lot of ideas. And I think the rumor was 2011 summer, he was making it, but it just ended up being Super 8.
I mean, which could be a Cloverfield movie. I think we'll discover that by the end of this retrospective.
Yeah, there's a lot of movies that could be Cloverfield movies that JJ has touched.
But you know what? I actually feel like JJ doesn't make Cloverfield movies. If you notice, all three movies in this franchise, he didn't write them. He didn't direct them. He wrote and directed Super 8. I think on some level, he thinks his stuff is a little bit higher shelf than this stuff. This is what newbies that work for me and write episodes of my show can do. This is the next step in the chain. But he himself, for him, he wouldn't do Cloverfield 2.
Okay, that first Cloverfield movie, obviously that's a Cloverfield movie. It's about a monster that sets the tone. Did this start out as a Cloverfield movie, or did they like just pick a script out of a pile and they're like, throw some monsters at the end of it, then it's Cloverfield?
Ding, ding, ding. I mean, of course, right? It feels that way, right? It was a script called The Cellar, And it was written, spec, everyone in town wanted it. If it had been bought by another production company, it would probably have been made as is. The guy that wrote it was the editor of those Narnia movies, and it could have been anything. I didn't get a copy of it, but I did read what it was and how different it is. I know that the skeleton essentially is the same here. The main character was a co-ed. She was younger, so she was more in the age of the daughter that goes missing. And she, you know, basically a lot of it feels like a kidnap thriller. You know, she's trying to get away from a man that she thinks has kidnapped her. And then at some point, a third man breaks in, changing the dynamic. As we go through the movie, I'll tell you what that is. But it was a three-person character piece about a co-ed trapped in a cement bunker. And Bad Robot said, yeah, we want to make this with Damien Chazelle. This is a good project for him. He's an up-and-coming writer. And he was so up-and-coming that he said, nah, after doing his polish on the script, I think I'm going to go make Whiplash instead. And then I'm going to win the Best Director Oscar for La La Land, and I'm going to be way too good for this franchise.
He made good choices.
But his name is still on the script. The movie that we're here is his work to the original Seller script. But again, I think the idea of doing a straight sequel was something that they were always open to but didn't know how to do, particularly since they had done all of this other stuff. To sell the movie in Japan, they ended up like writing this manga that never got translated to English.
Is it all about the Slurpee?
Yeah, it went all in on the Slusho stuff. And the one thing I can tell you I didn't bring up last week, but if you remember, the event that seemed to kick everything off was an oil tanker that overturned. Well, if you read that comic book, and I didn't, but I read about what it said, it shows you how the parent company, it's not obviously the Slurpee company itself, but the parent company has its fingers in a whole lot of pies, and they are concerned with energy, and they had an oil platform, and they dug it up, and it ended up like splicing DNA with like school kids, and they control the parasites. It sounded really weird and like a Japanese thing that would never work as a straight sequel. But in the end, one of the eggs of the creature that they had ended up on the oil tanker. And so it supports the idea that that egg hatched, overturned, and that's why a giant baby monster is running around Manhattan in the first movie.
Okay, that adds very little to the first movie for me, but I think they could have added more by bringing the monster back in this one and showing us what happened after the New York thing.
Yeah, and I think by the end of this film, the Slurpee company is not involved anymore. I don't know, unless they have UFO technology.
What really did it was Pacific Rim and Godzilla. Like, they were, JJ was like, after those movies, why, how can I compete? Like, they're spending way more money on the kind of thing that I was trying to get going. They took my idea and ran with it, and I don't have the kind of cash to do what they're doing in the visual effects department. So it looked like Cloverfield was pretty much dead until, yeah, they got this idea about turning this cool spec script that was, you know, could have been a Blumhouse thriller and turning it into a sidequel, I guess is what I would call it. And they decided to promote it in the same way. It had a big, not only did it have the Hush Hush marketing campaign, but it had a viral marketing campaign that I knew nothing about. But apparently, when you watch the first trailers for this, it came embedded with coordinates.
I remember that, yeah.
Somebody apparently went to those coordinates. It was in Louisiana where the movie was shot. And they dug a hole, and they found a box in it with a whole bunch of, like, survivalist supplies.
Just to be fair, geolocating stuff like that was the rage.
That was a big thing, yeah.
Yeah, about 8 years ago, where people would just go and leave little trinkets and then post online on, go to this coordinate. I mean, they were doing it back when LiveJournal was a thing, and then MySpace and Twitter and Facebook. And so that was a thing that was going on. Nobody at the Bad Robot marketing department created that entire concept, but it's cool that they buried a box.
Yeah, again, JJ mystery boxes. Like, what could be more perfect than somebody filming the digging up of it, putting it up on YouTube, and inside, along with several little things. I'll tell you, I'll save one of them because it's an in-movie joke, but we'll get there. But they also had thumb drives full of files, and they uploaded those files, and wouldn't you know it, there's John Goodman in character calling himself Radio Man 70 and talking a little bit more about his job with the Navy. And so people coming into the movie would think that it definitely, the way he was talking about his work and picking up frequencies in outer space, that he had actually gone crazy, perhaps. Not unlike Lovecraft. If you know Lovecraft mythos, the more that characters find out about these giant monster gods, the more they lose their mind. It looked like John Goodman was someone that was sliding into insanity because he was probing outer space and radio waves. And they also put up a blog of his daughter, Megan. Like, she actually had, like, you know, full of, like, silly kitten photos and unicorns and all of that. But the dad would post things in the comment section and beg her to come to him and leave methods on how to hotwire a car and drive back to Louisiana. So kind of fun stuff. I do like that stuff, but I wasn't aware of any of that stuff, and I don't go to Reddit. I feel like if that community is out there, they're all like talking about it in what feels like a pretty small space.
Yeah, I just remember a trailer with I Think We're Alone Now playing.
Yes, that too.
So when did you first see this, Stuart?
Yeah, I went opening weekend, and I didn't know anything. Again, I didn't even think that it necessarily had a monster. That was the big anticipation of, like, what will its connection be, if any? And I kept myself free of spoilers, saw it within the first 2 days of it coming out. And, yeah, remember feeling impressed with it. Remember liking it, feeling like it was an improvement of the other one. And that the ending felt like a confirmation, not necessarily a left-field surprise. Some of the audience, I remember being like, what?
Yeah, if you didn't know what Cloverfield was, and you're like, let's go see this paranoid thriller called 10 Cloverfield Lane. Like, I think this ending would throw you for a loop if you had no idea.
Well, I pulled this on my mom. I actually did that. I said, Mom, you want to watch this thriller? It's supposed to be really good, like Hitchcock. And she would never watch anything with a UFO in it. So she was like, oh, sure. And I'm like, let's just see how this is going to go. And so I wanted that to be my barometer coming back to it this time, 4 years later, is how did it play for me as a repeat viewing, knowing all of the surprises, and what does it mean for an audience member that knows nothing about the movie we talked about last week? And it was a hit. I mean, almost as big a hit as the first one in the States, 70 million, not 80 million.
This one had a cost less to make, though, right?
No. I think it was a similar budget, similar U.S. presence, but far less interest internationally. I think it only made half of what Cloverfield. I mean, when you blow things up and, you know, do something visually spectacular, that plays in countries where English is a second language.
Yeah, you don't want to have to read a lot of subtitles. This one, yeah, you're going to have to read a lot.
Yeah, so I think that might have contributed to the overall haul being smaller by about 80 million. So, Arnie, why don't you give them the plot and we'll find out what happened at 10 Cloverfield Lane.
When Mary Elizabeth Winstead's character, Michelle, wakes up after a bad car accident, she finds herself chained up in a bunker.
I love how you just skip, like, the first 20 minutes of all these films in your summary.
Human drama, blah.
Did you want me to include the phone call from the boyfriend?
No, just an observation.
I get into the plot, which usually kicks off at about the 30-minute mark. She is seemingly a prisoner of Howard Stambler, played by John Goodman. Howard is a survivalist and claims that above ground a disaster has killed all life on Earth. The only human survivors are Michelle, Howard, and Emmett, a workman who helped Howard build the bunker, played by John Gallagher Jr. Emmett completely trusts and believes Howard, but Michelle doesn't believe Howard's story. She's been hearing cars and helicopters above ground. She steals Howard's keys and runs to the surface, but when she does, she finds a woman, clearly diseased, banging to be let into the shelter. This convinces Michelle that Howard is telling the truth, and the three of them live a peaceful life underground for a time. When the air purification system malfunctions, though, Michelle is the only one small enough to crawl through the vents and restart it. In that chamber, Michelle finds another exit to the surface, and on the window of that exit, someone scratched the word help with their fingernails. Emmett and Michelle conclude Howard had previously kidnapped a local girl and kept her captive. Michelle, who wanted to be a fashion designer, draws plans for a homemade hazmat suit, because those are the exact same skill, and she builds the suit with Emmett's help. But Howard notices some missing tools and kills Emmett, dissolving his body in acid. Michelle finishes the suit and flees the bunker through the vents, pursued by Howard. She pushes him into the acid in order to escape and makes it to the surface, where she finds the air is completely safe. But in the distance are alien spaceships. When Michelle makes some noise, one ship comes and gases the area to again exterminate all life. but Michelle is saved by her homemade suit. She drives off and hears on the radio that there are survivors, and she drives towards one of the settlements as credits roll.
And Jacob, you joked that it took 30 minutes for us to get into the plot, but it's actually quite efficient. It's only 6 minutes and could have been quite longer. One of the big changes from the early drafts of the script to the movie we're here to watch is we really don't know much about Michelle's life before she becomes a victim. Whereas, would you have liked to have known why exactly she didn't want to have anything to do with her fiancé Ben anymore?
I mean, I guess we're going to find out she has this whole story about abuse and wanting to help this abused girl. I don't know, maybe if that relationship revolved around that somehow, it would have mattered. But I'm fine with this. Like, yeah, let's get to it. She's having a breakup. Again, when I'm first watching this, I'm like, is she fleeing because the monster is making its way west across the country?
That's what I was thinking. I thought for sure, because she's throwing things, she's packing quickly. I'm like, oh, the disaster is occurring. And so she needs to flee the disaster, and it might be the monster. I mean, that would be against expectation. Start with the monster and then go the rest of the movie without it. But no, she's just leaving her fiance. She leaves a diamond ring. I'm assuming they're engaged.
Not to mention, you look out the window and it's another harbor. She's as close to the water as the characters last time were, but this is New Orleans. And she drives, I don't know how long it takes to get out of New Orleans, but it seems like she drives all damn day and they're still selling po' boys and slushos when she gets to this gas station.
It also seems like she's the only car on the interstate, and I've been to New Orleans. That is never the case.
Yeah, it takes her a while to get out of Louisiana, and the reason is, of course, that Bad Robot has a production facility in Louisiana, and they shot everything here. This is one of these weird instances, kind of like Robert Rodriguez does this in Austin, where everything is in-house. And so if you want to tweak the script, if you want to do some things to the special effects, editing, shooting, all of it is happening within the walls of Bad Robot, Louisiana, and so they have the story here for that reason.
Yeah, and I think it's efficient the way we're going to get into the plot. We see Michelle, she goes to a gas station. Is someone watching her?
What's interesting to me about this beginning is Michelle doesn't say a word until she's in that bunker. You talk about how she's at the gas station, and yes, it made me think, as a single woman alone at a gas station at night, she gets a little nervous when men walk up, you know. It's something that women talk about having a universal experience of, and we men don't understand, and I think that was done subtly. But when she's leaving the house, when she's at the gas station, even when her fiancé calls her, she doesn't speak at all. She lets him speak to just dead air, and then she hangs up on him.
And did you guys recognize the voice?
No.
It was a favor that JJ called in. I forget that Bradley Cooper's career started with Alias, but that's him.
I don't know if that's so much a favor, if that's not a marketing point. Like, I don't remember seeing Bradley Cooper. Come see 10 Cloverfield Lane for Bradley Cooper.
I didn't know Bradley Cooper was on Alias.
Oh, yeah. That's where he started. He was the other guy. They had this other guy that was supposed to be the big star, and he was like the weenie that got killed early on, and then the star never went anywhere, and he became him.
I didn't recognize the voice, I guess because he didn't sound like Rocket Raccoon.
And he wasn't supposed to go away. This is the only interaction she has with Ben, but in the original script, and even in the later drafts, the expectation was she was always thinking throughout her encapturement and even getting out what she was going to do with Ben. And I wonder if you guys feel like that is missed. Why set it up this way? If Ben is in the first act, shouldn't he be in the third act? There were attempts to do so. I'll tell you when we get there. But is that a mistake?
I never really felt like she needed to reconcile with Ben. I think the way they frame Michelle's character, it's her learning to stick up for the little guy, the little girl who's being abused, and that's her journey. I don't know what Ben has to do with that.
Well, that thing you keep referencing is something they shot at the last minute to add in to change that. That wasn't the character. That was something they threw in at the very last second.
The scene in the middle of the movie?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, then, if there was something about Ben, I mean, it's not in this film, so I don't see his purpose.
If I was breaking up with someone, even engaged, a really serious relationship breakup, but I've decided to leave that relationship, and it seems like she's pretty firm on that decision, and then the end of the world comes and I'm kidnapped, the last thing on my flippin' mind is going to be, I wonder what's happening with my ex. Can I get back together with my ex? I think survival becomes the number one thing. I would immediately red arrow this movie and lambast it if this movie was her pining about her ex while chained up in a basement. I mean, and the girls in Split didn't wonder about their bows.
Well, I mean, but the movie last week was all about this. That was the human drama.
But it wasn't good, so.
The whole thing was, oh, we had this fight, and now I feel like I want to fix that. And so that would have been another way to make this feel like a Cloverfield movie.
There's a little bit of a difference between a hostage situation, though, and a disaster, where you feel like you can get the girl out of the disaster and reconcile, versus here, where you are a chained-up prisoner when you wake up. Vastly different scenarios.
And let me be clear, she's getting text messages from Ben throughout the movie. She finds there are hot spots where she can get her phone to work. So he is communicating with her. He is not just dropped out until the very last second.
If he's not telling her what's going on above ground, that would just be destructive to this movie. If he's not telling her what's happening above ground, then it's a bullshit text thing. If he is telling her what's happening above ground, then there's no suspense about what's outside the door, which is what this movie is going for it.
I mean, obviously, they do that carefully so that he implies things without... I mean, that it would become a part of the game of implying what's going on.
Yeah, and we're told early on, again, before she's even waking up and being locked up in the cellars, when the radio's playing, they talk about these huge widespread blackouts along the southern seaboard. So again, I think they're planning those ideas. Whatever a Cloverfield movie is, they're planning ideas early that something bigger is going on.
Yeah, and they're also playing with, like, it's hard to keep track of details, because if you notice, it's 6:26 on her phone, but it's 12:16 on the car radio, and which one is right, and is there a time difference or something? I found myself at first trying to pinpoint how time works, and then realizing over the course of this movie, you lose track of that. That's part of the struggle.
They didn't have a feature where they'd take you along the map and show you where everything's happening. You're just in one cellar the whole time on that feature.
The interactive part is not as fun as it was in Cloverfield. Yeah, she's just sitting there in one spot the whole time in the map. No, they didn't do it.
And they also don't show you the accident happening. She never sees it coming, so we never see it coming. She's driving, she's hanging up, possibly a little distracted driving. And then the car's just spinning, flipping. Then the opening title, and she wakes up, and it's Shades of Misery, I thought, with the IV in. I'm like, a person rescued from a bad car wreck, wakes up by somebody who has just enough medical knowledge to fix them, but make them prisoner. I was seeing some parallels at the beginning.
Certainly, and the only real difference is that Michelle's got fight in her. She's, from the get-go, assumes she's in a very bad predicament. I mean, who wouldn't when your leg is chained to a cement wall? And so she's going to try to get out there. You know, she's going to try to whittle crutches into spears and get to her phone. And she lets us know very early that she is a tough character.
I like this. I like that she is smart and she is not passive. She does not take time to figure out, hey, this guy's a little creepy, and then decide to escape. Instantly, he gives her some crutches and says, learn to use them. Instantly, she's whittling it into a stake to stab the guy with. I like this. I like her in this moment. This is giving me the empathy for her because she is not going to be a dumb horror movie victim.
Yeah, and who would assume that this man is telling you the truth? First of all, he's not saying anything for a while. He's trying to say, I'm keeping you alive, be grateful. He's mumbling, and he just kind of looks stalkery. I mean, John Goodman is scary in this movie. He's normally a very affable, fun-loving character, but I feel like he's really dialed that back. He knows when to play comedy in this movie, but yeah, you would just naturally assume he has bad intent, and we're on her side.
He gets a great entrance, and I think it's because it's John Goodman and he is known for comedy. They don't just show him. They treat him almost like one of the dinosaurs in Jurassic Park. You see a shadow behind the door, and then you see a leg. You see the gun on the hip. You see these extreme close-ups, but you don't get to see the face for a little bit. What you see is the fear in Mary Elizabeth Winstead's face, and that is going to help that when you see John Goodman all grizzly and unshaven, you've really been built up that this guy is scary before you see his face. And John Goodman is great here. I've always thought he was an actor with range. I'm not the hugest Big Lebowski fan, but I know a lot of people like it. I think while comedic, he showed a different type of comedy there.
I mean, I would say, Coen Brothers, I've seen him play kind of criminal guys, but it's Coen Brothers, like when he's the Cyclops in Oh Brother or in Raising Arizona. He's always comedic. I think this is the first time I've been scared of John Goodman.
He was dramatic in Tremé. That was a New Orleans show. I think he's from this area, right? That's partly probably why he signed on to do this movie. It was down the street. He was like, sure, I can show up at your studio, no problem. But yeah, I've seen him do dramatic. I cannot think of any role where he was menacing. Even in the Coen Brothers, I think of him as comic before menacism.
You know where I felt he got a lot of range? I was a big fan of Roseanne in its first run, and Roseanne would have dramatic episodes, and Roseanne would have episodes that got violent, and they would film John Goodman. I mean, it's a sitcom, so take it for what you will, but they'd film him, and he would posture in such a way as to be physically menacing. So you got to see a lot of aspects of John Goodman, not just the Joker on the first Roseanne series, but to see him play that role entirely, he does really well. He is imposing, but he's also slightly on the verge of crazy, right? Like, you never quite know how much he's going to say is true or just nonsense.
Yeah, well, that's what I find fascinating with this film is you're always going back and forth with this character. Is he telling the truth? Is he crazy? Is he a danger or is he helping? Like, I think that's one of the brilliant things about this script is with his character, you never know. And yeah, the fact that he's got this little speech impediment lisp thing going on. It throws you off. You're not quite sure how to take him, especially if you're familiar with this actor. It was just such a different role than I've seen him play before.
Yeah, I think we don't trust him until 16 minutes in where he starts talking about there's been some kind of attack. And I don't know what it is, but the radios aren't working anymore. And I have been preparing for this kind of day for a long time. Because Cloverfield people know that this has got to involve some kind of giant monster. Suddenly he has credibility with us. But he's still got to earn it with her. There'll be another 13 minutes before she believes that the air is actually poisonous.
I wasn't sure. I know this is a Cloverfield movie, but the air wasn't poisonous in the first one. Could there have been an explosion? And this guy, if you've been preparing for disaster your whole life, you're going to be happy when it finally occurs and you get just even the faintest whiff of it, you know? So when he's saying all this to her, I'm as skeptical as she is that she couldn't just walk outside and be normal, especially she hears cars, she hears helicopters.
Right. And then she hears a big bang because Emmett is trying to break in.
I had no idea there was a third party in this movie. I really thought this was like a two-person play, that it was just going to be Goodman and Winstead playing off each other the whole time. So when Emmett showed up, I was like, okay, I like that he is a person whose allegiances will change. And he's perhaps the more neutral perspective.
Yeah, in the finished movie, I feel like almost instantly, I gravitate to him, and I never feel like he feels like he could be manipulated, but he himself is not a manipulator. The interesting thing about the original script is he proves to be the ultimate bad guy. He is the one that actually is doing the wrong. They do a final twist on Howard that he isn't so bad after all.
That would have been really interesting, yeah.
It seems like a more typical way to go. The one you don't expect, that's really the bad guy. I do like Emmett here because he gives credibility to Howard because, look, Emmett, he's kind of like HUD. He's the comedic role here. He's going to give us the laughs. And so you put your guard down. You're willing to kind of believe with him and kind of believe him and go with him because he trusts Howard. He helped build this bunker with Howard. And so, okay, maybe Howard's not the dangerous guy that we would assume because, you know, Michelle wakes up chained in a cellar.
Now, if this happened to you, obviously it's upsetting. You think about all the people in your life that you're not going to see. They're using the words like nuclear. So, you know, you're at least here for 3 or 4 years. Do you think you can make it here? Like, looking around, like, they got books, they got movies.
VHS! He has VHS that he wants you to put back in his sleeve.
He has some cannibal movie, which didn't seem like a Howard movie.
Cannibal Airline?
But maybe it's whatever he could grab.
It might have been something his daughter liked, or the other teenage girl.
Yes, Pretty in Pink, I think, was more her flair, but who am I to say? I didn't read her blog entirely.
But there was a lot of jugs of stuff there. And with an air purification system that's going to keep giving new oxygen, yeah, I had no problem giving it that you could stay a couple of years down there.
Come on, you've seen Blast from the Past, haven't you?
Oh, many times.
Totally credible.
I haven't, but that's okay. In walking around here, we realize that while it is a man cave, there's definitely a feminine touch. There are Teenager magazine. Well, maybe that is meant for the middle-aged man, but it's published with the intent of a female teen readership. And we start to hear about Megan. And it will be probably 30 more minutes before we have it fully articulated that Megan is the daughter that was taken from Howard by her mother to Chicago. Unless, of course, you've been reading the Reddit post and following all the viral marketing.
And why would you possibly leave Howard? What would possibly make you want to run states away from Howard?
Yeah. What would keep you there? How did he ever find a wife? I mean, that's really the questions here. He seems so scary at this point that it's nice when it finally turns and Michelle gets some kind of confirmation that bad things are up there. He takes her up. There is a doorway that leads all the way to a welcome mat, but don't walk out that door because look out there, there are dead pigs.
The thing is, Howard is just not very trusting. The fact that he chained her up just to start is not a great sign of trust, right? If you're trying to help someone, why would you chain them to a cement wall?
Yep.
And then carry a gun, keep the keys to yourself. I mean, again, he's bordering on crazy. So I will go with the short explanations that don't really convince me of what he says is happening outside. But everything else here is not exactly hospitable. It feels like a captive situation, despite how often he's like, I saved your life. If it wasn't for me, you'd be dead with all the other people up there.
Right. The question is he just a paranoid and thus he is, you know, bad things can happen and paranoids are sent spiraling further. He could be misinterpreting what's going on out there, or he could be designing all of it. Those hogs don't look like they died from breathing poison air. They look like they were chopped up.
Well, I thought they were just rotting and being eaten by flies.
Well, yeah, he could have just killed them as some kind of, you know, a plot to convince her something awful is going out there. I mean, that is not the proof I'm looking for, Howard. I need more solid proof, and we'll get some later on. But I do think with Howard, like, yeah, he rides this line. We find out he was a Navy man that did stuff with satellites. Like, he might be on the spectrum. Like, he's super smart when it comes to technical stuff, but yeah, a little paranoid and crazy and obsessive.
And of course, the person vetting him is Emmett, because that's the only reason that we can believe anything, right? That not all of this is just some kind of facade, is the fact that Emmett can vouch for him. I helped build this bunker with him. And so I know him to be a good guy. I know about certain things that he's saying are true.
And not just that, Emmett says he saw the attack. He saw a red explosion in the sky. He knows something happened out there.
Right. So again, I think Michelle is at an interesting place of that may be, but I'm hearing things up there and I'm feeling like I'm not ready to commit to the idea that the air is poison. That feels like paranoia. And so she's going to have an elaborate plan to steal the keys at dinner.
And this shows again that Howard isn't entirely helpful, because how she distracts him is by just flirting ever so slightly with Emmett, putting her hand on his hand, and Howard gets violent, shoves her up against the wall.
Yeah, we know something's going on with Howard when they sit down for dinner and he's like, Megan was a good cook. You'll learn to love cooking. Like, again, we feel something sinister, some kind of attraction there.
It's so ambiguous, it could read either way. So it's a Rorschach test. If you're inclined to believe that this is a stalker situation, and my mom was convinced of it. She was like, oh, making noise and all of that. Like, in her mind, there was no way that anything could be going on upstairs. It's obvious that people like this are predatory and feeding you lies. And you do try to grab their keys and get out of there any way that you can. Until neighbors are banging on doors and looking like they're melting.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if Michelle might let her in, you know? I mean, she does look like she has leprosy or something, something not right, but she isn't acting zombie-ish. I mean, she's asking for help.
I mean, she says, it only touched me a little. Like, that doesn't sound good.
No, she's doing a pretty good impression of Kane from Poltergeist 2 in my book. She's like, let me in! I'm like, there's no way that I am letting you in. You are just no way, lady. And so we don't really know what happened to Leslie, or at least I don't even think we know that her name is Leslie. That is what Howard eventually will say about her. I think she's my neighbor, Leslie. She obviously drove there. We see a car with the headlights still on. So their air is may not be poisonous, but something is happening to this woman. And so, again, it keeps the tease in play. There's reasons to believe that Howard is right to stay down in the bunker. And then there's reasons to believe that, yeah, this woman needs to get it out.
Yeah, I know after this moment when I first watched this, I'm like, okay, so maybe Howard, again, he's a little eccentric, a little paranoid, but maybe he is a good guy. And again, that's the fun of this movie is how much I go back and forth. But after, yeah, this incident with Leslie, I'm like, okay, so something is going on outside. So he was being helpful. He's going a weird way about it, but maybe you could trust him at this point.
But the moment you think you can trust him, it's also undermined because she sees his truck and it's dented up and she has a flashback.
It's got that paint on it. Yeah.
That it's the truck that hit her. And we saw a truck pull up at the gas station. We never saw a lot of that truck. We never saw who got out. Had he been stalking her since the gas station? He saved her life, but how much did he endanger it first?
But, you know, that as we're having those thoughts, you know, Michelle returns to her half-painted pink room and is thinking, what do I do? Howard comes clean. He says, you know what? I was the one. I heard it on the radio that this attack was happening. I was driving crazy. I pushed you off. And I, you know, the line is a funny one. I know I seem like a sensible guy, but at the time I wasn't myself. And so I just scooped you up and a few other of your things. I took a box of your stuff that included your fashion portfolios, but not the whiskey, because I don't want young girls don't do that kind of thing.
But later on, he's going to have her drink some of his personally distilled vodka.
Yeah, but only just so that she can be numb enough to sew his face back on. Yeah, it's a game here about, well, twofold. Like, what will she experience if she goes out into that world? And what is Howard's aim?
And I guess Emmett and Michelle talk like prisoners through a wall to each other. I don't know why. I got a jail feeling when they weren't talking face to face, but through a wall, back to back. And Emmett tells his backstory that, did it have any effect on you guys? Did you care that he, like, got a track scholarship to college and then was too afraid to go, so he missed his train on purpose?
I mean, it tells you about his character, why he would be okay just staying with Howard, even though he may suspect things as well. Like, that again, he's going to have his moment where he's got to take that risk and get out of his comfort zone. So I like that it has little character moments better than the original Cloverfield, where I don't feel like we got these moments where I really understood who those characters were as people.
And John Gallagher is just, he's very trustworthy. As an actor, you just feel he's earnest. I saw him first in a movie that Brie Larson, actually, her big breakout, Short Term 12, he was the romantic lead with her, and he was equally as good as her. I think that it comes through in the performance more than this thing they came up with. I'll just point out, most of this movie was shot in order to help the actors, but this scene was not, because again, originally they were thinking they were going to have Ben fulfill some of the things that Emmett is doing. And they came back at the last minute after these actors had haircuts and weren't there on the same day.
That's why they're back to back in different rooms.
Yes. They don't necessarily feel like they're having an intimate conversation, but not looking at each other. Part of that was just a logistical challenge that they had to do. But I think the scene ends up working. What's remarkable is, even though that this is kind of a hokey setup, it's core to understanding why they're going to make the choices that they do later. And yeah, she tells this story about basically being triggered by violent father figures. She had one and her brother protected her. And then she thinks about this moment, this second in her life where she was in the hardware store and saw a father hit a child and thinks about her reaction being something that makes her feel incredibly guilty. She runs when she should fight.
And I thought for sure the speech, while not subtle about it, was going to tell us her arc. She started off, she said, her specific words are, "When things get bad, I panic and run."
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did the movie start? She was panicking and running. She was really packing in a hurry because things apparently got bad with her boyfriend. Why bad? How bad? I don't know. Was it abusive bad? I don't know. But she panicked and ran. And so then she tells this other story about how she panicked and ran. I'm like, okay, her arc is going to be she's not going to run. Emmett's going to get in some trouble with Howard, and she's going to defend him, and that's going to complete her character arc. No, that's not what happens.
They will use this backstory, but you're right. It's not in the most predictable of ways. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about the ratcheting of the tension and the mystery about what's going on, but they're smart enough to realize, actually, it was a suggestion by the big studios. People at Paramount were like, you need some lightheartedness. We need some music. We need some comedy.
You need a montage.
Sure.
I think we're alone now. I was shocked to hear that song. It was not what I expected in this movie that had been so somber up till that point. It, of course, always will make me think of Tiffany.
It's also suggestive of the idea that at some point it's just going to be two and not three.
Definitely. And I think it's just a nice moment of levity, though. It does, again, make this feel more like a family where we've been so paranoid, like, how evil is Howard? What's going on outside? Okay, they've kind of cozied down and they're all getting along now.
And that jigsaw puzzle of the, they call it a catfish puzzle, but it's just a cat in scuba gear, missing pieces, it was actually in the mystery box that dug up. So the people online would get a subtle little joke there about where those missing pieces were.
Just the missing pieces were in the box?
No, well, among many other things.
So just the missing pieces of the puzzle, not the whole puzzle was there.
Correct, yes. If when the character says, I can't find the last three pieces, some people in the audience know exactly where they are. They're in a box buried, but that Howard put into the ground for people to find. By the way, do people know Fluffernutter? Is it an East Coast thing?
Oh, yeah. I know Fluffernutter. It's marshmallow fluff and peanut butter sandwiches where my jam is like a three-year-old.
I know marshmallow fluff. I don't know Fluffernutter. Maybe that's a Midwest East Coast thing. Not here in L.A.
I had never heard of it, and then New York friends taught me what it was. And apparently no one in New Orleans knew what it was, but the director was really big on them.
But here's where the movie makes another turn. When everybody is settled, everybody seems pretty much in a routine, as much as you can be when living in the small bunker, the air filtration system is going to break down. And I thought Howard was a survivalist. I thought Howard was smart.
This seems very ill-conceived on Howard's part. He's a big man. How's he supposed to fix this?
Exactly. He thinks he's going to be down there alone. The only way to get to this room, and it's a big room. I mean, it would add 20% to his square footage in his bunker if he could get there through a door. The only way to get there is to crawl through and climb through vents, and the only person small enough to do it is Michelle. This is a bad idea.
Yeah, I wondered if people would get what the director was talking about in the commentary. I certainly, like you guys, thought that that was a strange choice for someone that designed the layout of this. He didn't just inherit this bunker. He made it a certain way. What the director hoped that you would get out of this, certainly once she gets up there, we realize that someone was held prisoner there and that Howard walled it off because he didn't want to think about what he did to that person there.
I did not get that.
No, not at all. I didn't notice a wall that looked different from the others. It looked like she was just in some kind of silo when she got there.
Well, I mean, it's been several years since his last captive, so he's had time to remodel and redo lots of rooms. Probably the whole thing has been made over.
Yeah, I think it would have helped then if that was a point, like, to show the wall that looks different than the other ones. I mean, we're going to spend time up there. Michelle's going to find help scratched into the glass.
And the fingernails that scratched it, which...
Not to mention the jewelry, the earring is ultimately what's going to link it.
Yeah.
Because Howard had this picture of someone that he called his daughter Megan, a woman wearing the earring with blood on it. But in fact, when that picture gets shown to Emmett, he's like, oh, no, that's a classmate of my younger sister who went missing a few years back. And then they find Polaroids of Howard and this girl, Brittany, not Megan, hanging out together.
Yeah, wearing that shirt that Michelle is now wearing. She was told that it was Megan's shirt because she loved France, but no, it's actually Brittany's.
Yeah, so what we can really interpret it is that, all right, maybe listening to Outer Space Waves has made Howard a little bit crazy, but in doing so, it drove his wife and daughter away. He needed to create a new daughter, and he went out and grabbed one. And that this bunker is not just to protect himself from World War III, but to cage a young woman that he did not want out of his possession.
But in the photos, Brittany didn't look completely terrified. She didn't look enthused to be there, but she didn't look like a captive. Now, maybe she had just been beaten down. She'd been there for a while.
Yeah, we see how Howard acts. Like, he could be very threatening. Like, smile for the Polaroid, Brittany, or else. Like, yeah.
And who was taking that photo? I mean, the director teased that maybe there were other people there at that time that are no longer alive.
The thing is, were you guys convinced that was the story, that he really did kidnap Brittany and keep her there? I mean, the scrawling of help is an indicator, the earring is an indicator, but I never feel like we have definitive proof that Howard is a rapist, kidnapper, and that that's his ultimate intention for Michelle. I feel like there's just like that 10% of doubt.
We don't know how far that relationship went. The smart thing about this script is they're never going to tell you everything. You kind of piece it together. You're coming to your own conclusions, and then more evidence is shown that maybe contradicts that. Like, they find this photo and they just kind of assumed, okay, this guy's bad. He kidnapped this child, which probably pretty good assumption to go by. I don't know how far it went, but I'm willing to believe things were non-consensual.
You know what? It could be sexual or not, but I do believe he held a teenage girl that was not his daughter here. Again, the fact that the cement room is half painted pink and we'll see him watching Pretty in Pink, supposedly her favorite movie. I think that, yes, in his deluded mind, he thought he was having a wholesome relationship with his child, a surrogate daughter. What really went on is probably best left nebulous. I don't really need to know the gory details. She went into the vat of acid. I can tell you how it ended.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah, because there are no remains other than the fingernails. I guess for what happens to Howard, I like this movie for how it handles it with the nebulousness, because if I were in Michelle or Emmett's scenario in that situation, I'd feel there's enough circumstantial evidence to overtake this man, but it is all circumstantial evidence. There's nothing firm that says he is going to harm either one of them during this period of survivalist.
Yeah, that's going to come out later, that he definitely did have plans to get rid of Emmett and just be alone with Michelle.
Yeah, I guess what would your alternate theory be that gets Howard off the hook? Because again, I'm going to just say Howard is given off the hook in the original draft of the screenplay, and that we found out basically he wasn't called Emmett. I think his name was Nate in the original script. We would find out this whole story about how his real daughter died in a drunk driving accident that Howard committed. He's consumed with guilt, but he never did kidnap anybody else. And this other guy has, for reasons I can't quite remember, had it out for Howard and is happy to turn Michelle against him.
The one thing I can't reconcile is any scenario in which Howard isn't prime evil, where somebody is scratching help on the window with their fingernails till their fingernails come off.
Yeah, that's pretty damning.
They put so much on the idea that Howard is, at the very least, damaged and unhealthy, if not absolute evil. Would it be acceptable to turn around and find him to be the hero of the story? As the original script conceived of it, he would kill Emmett, and that would be a good thing, because in the end, Emmett had bad intent.
Yeah, I mean, I could go with it, because that's how I see this film. It's continually flipping, you know, what is going on, who you could believe, who you can't, what the truth is. It's really a search for that. So I could see it going in that direction.
Yeah, I think twists are good of the movie. I don't know that this actor could do it. What I think of when you mention that twist is Topher Grace in Predators, where that was that kind of a turn. And I think you get the right actor who could turn on that, and I would go with it.
Are you saying Topher Grace was the right one? Because that was awful in that film.
It was my favorite part of that movie, but I didn't like that movie.
Oh my God. It was the worst part of that movie. Almost made me hate it.
Yeah, I mean, Edward Norton would be a better comparison in Primal Fear or something like that, where you think he's a choir boy, but in the end, you're like, oh, okay, there's that side of you. Didn't see that coming. Again, it's what thrillers do. It's how they're designed. But I feel like this movie, again, the premise is not really to suspect that Howard is a hero. It's to say just because he's paranoid doesn't mean that there isn't something up above out to get them. Like, that's the real challenge of this movie, is that they're hearing things. Maybe they're helicopters. Maybe they're roars of monsters. It just, we can't be sure, as viewers of the movie last week, that Howard is completely wrong about holding up here.
And one of my favorite scenes, just as his paranoia has just boiled over, we've seen Michelle and Emmett, they've started making this hazmat suit, but then they're playing, what is this, the $1,000 pyramid, where they got to make clues and like guess the phrase, and you know, the word is little women, and Howard, he's saying little girl, little princess, little child, and then he gets Santa Claus, and he's like, I'm always watching. And I just love how everyone is misinterpreting everything that's going on here.
That is my favorite scene in the movie.
I did get that he was Santa Claus because he's like, I see you when you sleep. I'm like, oh, Santa. But yeah, I did enjoy that scene because it ratchets up the tension. Here's the thing. We're talking about this movie and we're going scene by scene because that's what we do. But throughout this movie, it's a tightening and releasing of tension, and Hitchcockian in that way. And this scene, because they've started their plan to create a suit and escape, and so they've been sneaking some scissors and things so that they can make it. And this has that pulled so taut. And then when you find out it's Santa Claus, it's like a chuckle release because he made Santa sound so stalkerish.
And one other thing I want to compliment in all of this release and ratcheting up of tension that you talk about, Arnie, is the skill of the people making this film. One of the reasons to watch it twice, I feel like this is a movie where, I don't know, a lot is spoiled after the first time. Like, it's hard to feel tricked by it. But the thing that's impressive is seeing how well they move the camera. This thing, despite being confined to three rooms below ground for 80% of the time, it really, the camera never stops moving. They because it's all constructed on a soundstage and they can pull out walls, they're able to do incredible things with spinning and tracking, and it really feels like a movie that's very free, even though it's obviously a movie about confinement.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like a cheap indie movie where, yeah, they're confined in this little space and they chose that for budgetary reasons. It does feel like a major production, even though, yeah, it is a claustrophobic bunker that they're staying in. That camera still has room to move.
Yeah, it almost felt a little bit not found footage handheld, but slightly handheld, because even in the still shots, it's like the camera was wavering just a little bit up and down.
Yeah, this thing is not easy to do. You're right. And on indie budgets, a lot of people film movies where they're in three rooms and that's the whole movie. And you feel like, wow, this is stagey. This feels like a play. I never feel like this movie feels like a play. That is an ultimate compliment to the cinematographer, the director, and the editor, and the sound designers.
Yeah, I was specifically thinking about the lighting when I watched this movie and how well lit it is to give it that bunker feel and to keep everything kind of a muted color and claustrophobic in that way. The outside of the frame is almost always going into blackness, whereas the center is where the brightness is. And I got thinking when I was thinking about this set, about when we were discussing Leprechaun in space of all things, and how cheap those sets looked when the spaceship and you could just see the cardboard bending. And here I knew they were on a set, but it looks 100% convincing. It could have been a bunker.
But I think we're pretty much approaching the climax at this point. It's time to change the dynamics. I think we're alone now.
Yeah, you talk about how that this tension is ratcheted, and then there's relief. And yeah, you get this funny joke about Santa Claus, ha ha ha, and then bring out the barrel. Like, get the acid. Things are going to go real bad now.
He doesn't know exactly what they're doing, but that all of that stuff he was doing during Scattergories or whatever that word association game does feed into the idea. At this point, he thinks that they're up to something. He's found the box cutter and some scissors have been moved. You know, he's pretty anal retentive about all of his things. And so he knows they're up to something. Tell me what it is, or you're going into this barrel of perchloric acid.
That I guess he stole from the naval base he worked at? It's said it's used to make fuel for satellites.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd not heard of that type of acid, but it will dissolve bone. I'm like, okay, that seems... I definitely feel somebody's going in that vat before all is said and done. And here's the moment, right? Because he's got the box cutter and he's got the scissors, so he knows something's up. And Emmett is going to stand up and take the blame solely and guard Michelle, the way Michelle talked about her brother doing when she was young, how the brother would protect her. And so Emmett does this, and I'm like, this is the moment she's going to protect Emmett. She's going to make sure that nothing happens. Oh, Emmett's dead.
Bang. Nope. Emmett's shot in the head. And Arnie, you're saying there's a 10% chance that Howard wasn't going to do anything bad. I mean, after he kills Emmett, he says, this is the way it was always supposed to be. He never wanted Emmett there. He just, oh, I know this guy helped me build the bunker. I guess I'll have to let him in. But he always wanted to be alone with Michelle.
Okay, you're right. You're right. I didn't think about that specific line. But yes, this is where he would become very dangerous.
And yes, this is a PG-13 movie. They do not show us. They apparently filmed it. They had, like, cast his head and blood spatter and did all of that. But the MPAA is not going to let them do that on a PG-13. I don't think you need it, even if it's a great effect shot.
Yeah, it is so just all of a sudden. It shocked me when it happened.
I couldn't believe Emmett was shot so quickly. And yeah, you don't see him shot either. But it was like, damn, just so quick. But now that you've pointed out that line to me, Jacob, Howard wanted to kill him no matter. He was looking for a reason.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. It was always going to go this way because this is where we find out that Howard indeed has malevolent designs on this little woman, as it were.
Yeah, you see he's now shaved that beard off and he's bringing her ice cream and saying he wants to be a happy family.
And so, yeah, she's got to do whatever she's got to do. She's got to do it. And, you know, it's a couple hours before dinner, time to spruce up this homemade PPE that she's been cooking up with thrown away bottle caps and a shower curtain with a rubber ducky on it.
I love how Emmett plays Howard. He's like, you know, when Michelle touched the air purifier, could she have gotten some of that really concentrated and then come back and put it in the shower and the shower curtain? Because they can't just take the shower curtain. Howard's going to notice. But if you make Howard throw it out.
Yeah, they play on his paranoia.
Exactly.
Yeah. So, we're now fully on into where we were at the beginning. She's trying to escape. He can't believe that she's not grateful. And it's a real showdown.
It's tense. It gets really horror movie-ish at this point with her running from him and the vents with the knives coming in. But I was just happy as could be when she kicks that acid on him. I'm like, yes, yes. I thought that was the end of him.
Does not take him out. But yeah, he goes a little two-faced there. His face starts melting.
It reminded me of the toxic waste from RoboCop.
And it's a really cool shot, too, because it's all one take. Again, when you watch these things the second time, you can appreciate the craft. The first time, you're just reacting to the emotion of the moment. But the way that, like, in one shot, she kicks it over, grabs the ledge of the doorway, swings over the acid as he's fallen face down into it, and then we track back and watch that acid hit the electrical cord and start the fire. Really impressive stuff.
Yeah, the threat of fire was there. It was set up early because she tried to set a fire to draw in Howard earlier before she knew, or to try to stab him. So the thought of a fire underground had always been lingering in the back of our mind. Now there's no choice. She has to get the hell out because the place is burning up. And again, Howard coming at the knife with the knife in the vents and things. It felt like standard slasher stuff, but it was fun.
Yeah, no, I think this is a tense movie. I'm into it. They've set up this, what is this, Freon stuff that we saw Howard using to cool that homemade vodka down with, and he tells a story, oh, we used to break locks off of our naval officers' doors with this stuff, and so, of course, Michelle grabs that because she's got to get out of there, and that's how she's going to get that lock off the door.
I don't think upside-down canned air can break a lock.
Is that all? I was wondering, is it just canned air that you use to clean your keyboard with?
I think so, yeah.
There is something called freezing spray, but I mean, I don't know.
But she was holding the bottle upside down. I mean, that's what he was doing earlier, is the bottle was upside down, and that's why it sprayed freezing stuff.
That stuff does get cold when you hold it upside down.
I feel like we're tempting people to do some really bad experiments at home. Do not, kids, do not try it at home.
Because when I was in college one time, I was helping some friends with a project, and I needed to hammer a nail, and there wasn't a hammer. So I grabbed a can of spray paint and started hammering the nail, which is what she's...
Oh, that's a bad idea.
Which is what she's doing here. She's taking that can and using it to hammer at the lock.
Did the can blow up?
It did not. I used the rim. I knew what I was doing.
You didn't puncture it?
But to this day, one of my college friends continues to bring up to me, hey, don't forget the spray paint hammer. So no, don't do that. It could explode.
So she gets up to the surface. Of course she would. And of course she's going to tear her suit.
But birds are flying. It's okay to take the mask off. Which, look, I don't care if birds are flying. That's dumb.
It is, but she'd already torn the suit. It was kind of foregone that at some point she'd have to breathe the air. The thing that got me was the woman who showed up earlier. I mean, whatever killed you doesn't kill you instantly. It kills you slow. So just because you take off your helmet and inhale and you don't fall over dead right then doesn't mean you're not infected.
Sure.
But I gotta ask, Stuart, because the whole time I thought we were gonna get the Cloverfield monster, but when this alien ship pulls up, I'm not surprised. I've been expecting something. But how does your mom take this when, yeah, you think she's made it? Oh, there really is no danger out there. Aliens.
It's funny because it takes her a while, longer than it should have, to realize. Like, she sees it and she's like, oh, there's the helicopter.
I thought so too, though. I thought it might be a high-tech Russian helicopter.
The tentacles coming down, she's still, like, unfazed.
Okay, at that point I knew it was a spaceship.
No, she's like, it really isn't until the thing is flying over the house fumigating that she's like, wait, it is aliens? Like, she just was not accepting of this premise.
Yeah, I don't know how I would have taken this if I had no idea what this movie was. We just sat down and watched it. I never, you know, had seen Cloverfield before, but I like that this is about a character who is evil, but also is telling the truth about some things. Like, there really is something sinister going on there. And okay, it's aliens. I guess aliens brought the Cloverfield monster, if these are supposed to be related.
Yes, obviously not the same creature, or even structurally even kind of close. It looks like a little crab thing with...
Yeah, we'll see some alien running around on the ground.
Yeah, it can come and go, but it's like a snail to me. It feels like I live in my metal ship, but I can come out if I want. I can poke out a little bit and sniff around as well. And if you remember, they had a, for reasons, Howard had a crop duster hanging up in his personal room. There was a picture of just a crop duster. What was that about? That's the director was saying, I'm tipping you off that I love North by Northwest. And this shot specifically, if you've seen that film, there's a very famous scene. Cary Grant trying to outrun the crop duster is almost shot for shot the way that Mary Elizabeth Winstead is trying to get away from this green gas coming out of the ship, coming over the house.
Even if you haven't seen the whole movie, that shot is everywhere. It's like in
I haven't seen the movie. I know that shot, though.
Yeah.
But could it / should it have been the same monster from last time? Would that have been more fulfilling if you're going to call this a Cloverfield movie? I mean, at this point, what does Cloverfield mean other than, hey, you liked the last one, come see this one too?
To me, it means that there's more than one monster, and it could be a whole different kind of alien invasion. Like, they're not uniform. They're not all the same race, but, like, who knows? It could be different factions fighting each other. But yeah, it just tells me that there is, if I bought the statue last week, I better save up for Christmas, because every Cloverfield movie could potentially have different forms of alien invasion coming and arriving. And so it expands the world. It doesn't need to be, and nor would I really understand how she could take down the monster last week, like, alone.
Yeah. But it does raise questions, like, if I'm trying to create a unified Cloverfield theory based on just these two movies, we haven't got to the Paradox yet, that will be next week. But based on these two, like, this is called 10 Cloverfield Lane. I brought up the idea that maybe that monster was some kind of experiment or you know, some kind of government code word for a project they were working on. Now we get Howard, who is a naval guy studying satellites. Like, did he come up with that code word, Cloverfield, because that's where he's living? Like, I am trying to piece these things together because they're telling me they're the same universe somehow.
And again, some of the viral marketing does actually link Howard to Slusho, to things that are in the first movie. So if you really want to obsess over that, I suppose you could leave the movie theater and spend the next several days reading and scouring the internet.
See, and my taking of this is it's an anthology series, and we're going to use Cloverfield the way we'd use The Twilight Zone. Cloverfield is going to be suspense movies that are going to involve some kind of strange creature, but I didn't think this was in the same universe as the last Cloverfield film.
Oh, I definitely did. The fact that the radio said the East Coast was getting under control. She finally, you know, takes this thing out with she remembered to take that whiskey, that scotch. She was like, I gotta take scotch.
I have to ask, was this a reshot ending or a new ending? Because they don't show her. A person walks past a bottle of scotch and it just disappears. You don't see her pick up the bottle of scotch, and then she uses it here at the end. I wondered if they did some kind of pickup shot. Just the weird way the scotch disappeared made me wonder if this had always been their plan, or if at the end they're like, crap, where'd she get the scotch? Let's do a shot for the beginning.
Well, my understanding was the scotch was always in there, and they shot the beginning at the beginning. So the things that were in that room that they were setting up, the ring, all of that stuff, were things that were coming back. Again, Ben was coming back. She was going to emerge from this fight saying, finally, getting all of the rest of her text messages, bloop, 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 bloop. And Ben is in trouble. It's finally clear that what he was talking about is that he is being attacked by aliens, maybe that very Cloverfield monster from Manhattan. And she had the choice of running away or going to save him, and decided to go save him. They decided, it's more interesting if we think of her as not being dependent on a man and is going to save Houston and not run away to Baton Rouge.
I like that it seems to go more in line with that story about the little girl at the hardware store, that there wasn't a personal relationship. She just wanted to stand up for this child that was being abused. So the fact that, yeah, she could either go to the safe shelter in Baton Rouge, or she go to Houston and fight to try to save, you know, humanity, just a general term, that's her decision. I think it goes more in line with what they set up with that story.
My problem with this is I feel like it's a weak-ass ending for her. When she's fighting the alien, I think she's going to die. And the reason I think she's going to die is because she did not fulfill her arc. She did not save Emmett. So when this alien has her, and knowing the ending of the last Cloverfield movie was pretty nihilistic, I'm like, there's no guarantee that she's going to survive this film. There's no promise that she will. This could end with her being eaten. When she survives that, and then she's driving away, and you hear the radio say, if you need salvation, head to Baton Rouge. But if you are able to provide medical care, go to Houston.
Yeah, she is a fashion designer. She's not a nurse. She's not a doctor.
Or fight. I mean, they mentioned combat as well. And I think that's what she's identifying with, is that she has the coming out of that experience in the bunker. She does not identify with someone that needs to run away. She is someone that can stand her ground and fight and defend those that need the help.
And if the military needs hazmat suits, just give her some shower curtains.
There's that
she'll
too.
She'll get those sewn up.
They just drilled home the medical care needs in Houston.
Yeah, that's why I'm calling it out, because that's what they emphasize, and that's not what we've seen.
And I'm like, she gave John Goodman a couple stitches. Is that good enough? Now she can be a war medic?
Medical training or combat experience, she has both. I would put both on her CV.
And we do see the threat. There's a flash of lightning. We see a giant spaceship in the distance. I guess we're never going to get a sequel to this.
Sure, we're talking about it next week, right?
I've seen what happens next week, so...
Well, before we get to next week, Jacob Stewart, do you recommend 10 Cloverfield Lane? Jacob.
Yeah, I think last week's, the original Cloverfield, that was just a fun monster movie. This is a great paranoid thriller where I never really know what the truth is. That is the fun, the journey of this film is... is this person telling the truth? Oh, they are. Oh, but then there's this twist and really coming to terms with like someone could be telling you the truth and also just be evil and bad. And so I thought that's really interesting here. And then there's the acting. Like we've talked about Mary Elizabeth Winstead with Birds of Prey. Like she was the best part of that movie. Like, why isn't she doing more? And I think she's great here. Like she's typically really good in things she does. But John Goodman, that was a huge surprise for me because I've liked him in other stuff, but it's always been comedic roles. Even when he's playing a menacing character, it's still a comedic role. So to see him do something more dramatic and just this quiet, menacing persona that he's able to give off just really made me reevaluate him. I'm like, oh, wow, he could really do more. Like, I'd want to see John Goodman doing more dramatic stuff now because of this film. So, yeah, the fact that this is a Cloverfield movie and there's this weird alien thing at the end, like, it's hard for me to objectively come to terms, like, what would I think of that if I didn't know what this was? Because I was expecting some kind of monster throughout the movie because I had seen Cloverfield before. And so, but I like this twist. That I think that might actually be something really cool. Like, you're not expecting an alien movie. Here we just saw Howard, this crazy, maybe rapist, who knows? He's just been making up stories. Oh, no, he's actually telling the truth, and there are aliens out there. And, you know, it's a fun little twist to the end. But, yeah, I think what makes this work is it's not just about the toy you're going to buy of the monster and what is that finally going to look like, because this design ultimately doesn't matter of these aliens. They could have been whatever, but it's this confined, claustrophobic, paranoid thriller that is going on, and who can retrust, who can't retrust, and how it all plays out. I think this movie, it's just really great watching it a second time. You know, I'd seen it originally 4 years ago, and this is my second time seeing it. I was still grabbed and taken in by it, even though I knew where it was going. This is rewarding watching it multiple times because there is so much craft behind it. This is a strong recommend.
Stuart.
They managed to satisfy both. They managed to think about what worked in Cloverfield and continue on in those directions, but at the same time, do something original, something new and apart from the alien lore and just more in the tradition of Hitchcock. Like the first film, it keeps those characters in the dark about what the global event is. You know, what's happening, we don't know. They didn't know in New York, they don't know here in Louisiana. But it fixes the human drama, which was such a problem for me. And, you know, it helps that, as you point out, Jacob, Mary Elizabeth Winstead, John Goodman, I'm going to throw John Gallagher in there too, all of them much better actors than what came across as like guest stars on The OC or Dawson's Creek last time. I mean, they just, the difference is night and day, and I can go even if some of these setups are corny, again, like if those actors from last week had told that story about I saw a girl hit in a hardware store, we probably wouldn't have bought it. It requires a buy-in that comes from really having dramatic chops, and these folks have it. I'm also going to say this first-time director coming out of commercials, never worked on a feature before.
This is his first film?
Yeah, really proved himself. Wow. What an impressive feat for your first movie.
And his last movie, right? This is his only movie so far.
That's correct. I think he's working on stuff, but he's done some Black Mirror stuff. He works on The Boys, if you know that superhero show.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, he really managed to keep us hooked into a one-setting character piece that, again, the fact that it comes off as claustrophobic and not stage-bound, there's a big difference in that. And it would be very easy for this just to look like theater. And he made a movie. Mom, she was a little less impressed. I could tell she really liked it until that ending. And then it was just ruined for her. She was just like, I can't go with it. This is stupid. And she was done. And in a way, I get that. Because it is sort of all predicated on how's it all going to turn out in the end. It's a pot boiler. And what happens with the pot, you know, when the water boils over, there's nothing left in it. It's entertainment. Not really that different from the experience last time of this is basically a diverting carnival ride. It's just so much better made than last week. And so that's why I think that definite improvement from Cloverfield and definitely a solid recommend. It's a movie that even if you didn't like the movie last week, you should give it a look.
I'll both agree with some of what you have said, Stuart, and disagree with others. Where I agree is the great performances in this movie. And what I got thinking about when I was watching it is when you aren't trying to shoot in New York City and a back lot and doing a lot of CG with monsters and stealth bombers and things, you could actually take that money and just spend it on really good actors, you know? Because instead of having to have a huge effects budget and bring in, as you said, guest stars from Dawson's Creek. The performances here are really, really good. I don't know that John Gallagher has as much of a lift as the other two do, but he is perfectly fine in that role, too. I didn't necessarily care for his bus story. But where I'll disagree is you said that it's very similar to the movie last week. I think this is completely different in that last week it was an action disaster film where you were constantly following the characters. Really, it felt like you were one of the characters running and being attacked and just always on the run, always something chopping at your heels. Whereas this is a quiet kind of horror, a very different type until the very end. And I think it works so much better because of the people here. And yes, the cinematography, the lighting, the sound design, all of it creates a mood that I really enjoyed being in the bunker for that period of time, not for 3 years, but for this period of time, to see what happened and to unravel the mysteries. The ending, if John Goodman's character hadn't repeatedly discussed aliens, I would probably be pissed off about this ending, because there's not a whole lot to set it up other than coming in and knowing something about the last Cloverfield movie. If this movie had been called The Cellar and it ended with the aliens, is that as big of a shit ending as The Prestige? It might be, but
Prestige was great, so I would have loved it.
I like that ending. I like that movie, so probably is my answer.
That twist at the end is a shitza film. No, but I wouldn't have shit the bed with aliens if this hadn't been a Cloverfield film. Maybe. But I did have the meta-knowledge it's a Cloverfield film, so I'll give it its alien ending and say this is a really good suspense film. It's, to me, it felt, again, like an anthology, completely separate from the last one. You don't need to see the last one. You really should see this one. It is a really strong recommend.
And just to make clear, The Cellar did not end with aliens. It only has aliens because JJ said, we are making it Cloverfield. And so I think that's the theme. I haven't seen the movie next week, but I imagine somehow, some way, there's going to be some kind of extraterrestrial tie.
It could be Room with a View, and at the very end, a monster shows up.
Yeah, I think so.
All I know is it's in space, and people hated it.
Yeah, they were really happy for about an hour after the Super Bowl, and then I heard nothing good. But who knows? I'm up for it.
Absolutely. You know, it's been two recommends from me so far, so I'm having a good feeling towards this. I also have a good feeling towards our supporters. Thank you so much for going with the platinum level and joining us as we go through the Cloverfield movies, finally. And Jacob Stewart, thank you for staying in the bunker with me.
You bet.
Until next time, I had a good day.
You've got some fight in you. I can respect that. But don't even think about trying that again.
Once again, thank you for supporting Now Playing, and we hope you've enjoyed this bonus movie review.
Ooh, that's good. That was good.
Your support helps keep Now Playing on the air.
No, thank you, everyone. Thank you. It means a lot. So,
the opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You have no idea how much I would love to be wrong about this.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with, and this podcast has not been prepared, approved, or licensed by any entity that created the film analyzed herein.
You gotta learn to say, forget the world, and hang on to the people that you care about the most.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of their respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review, and no infringement is intended.
You think I sound crazy? It's amazing. You people.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
You have no idea how much I would love to be wrong about this.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2020, and no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
If this is the last thing you see, that means I died.
Was that originally a Tiffany song, or was Tiffany remaking that song?
Nope, that's a cover.
Oh, my God. Yes, Tiffany never did anything original.
She invented the mall tour, damn it.
You say so.
Guys, Tiffany played at my college.
Wow.
Free concert. They had to shut it down when she started playing I Think We're Alone Now, because everyone rushed the makeshift stage and just started, like, pogoing up and down, and they were afraid it was going to fall.
Ironically, or with full heart and intent?
I think with full heart. I don't want to say where I went to college, but I'm going to say with full heart with those people.
Fair enough. I'm not sure how I would react, but I can imagine getting
swept
up. I mean,
I was watching the thing ironically. I didn't rush the stage.
Yeah.
Okay, so the version in this movie is the original version.
Yes.
Okay.